This podcast is for general education, information, and entertainment purposes only, and is not to be used as medical advice for any particular patient. Clinicians must rely on their own informed clinical judgment in making recommendations to their patients. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policies or positions of any entity.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of BCR Pod. I'm Jamie Lynn.
And I'm Michael Fishman. We're both pediatric senior residents at NotSob Hospital and your hosts for this podcast.
We're going to be taking the next 15 minutes to review a few of the case-based residency conferences from the past week, a few of our tilts or things I learned today from our clinical shifts, and then highlight co-residents doing cool stuff towards the end.
And with that, let's get started. First case of Monday morning was presented by Dr. Marwa, who presented this case of a 60-year-old with autism who presented with polyuria and polydipsia and was ultimately found to have HHS. She gave a phenomenal lecture on HHS and DKA and the complications and morbidity. Some quick learning pearls. So altered mental status and DKA, should always be considering cerebral edema. Some red flags that I'll keep are looking for increased diastolic blood pressure, age less than 5, bradycardia and incontinence. Otherwise, broad thinking, DKA is too little insulin and HHS is too much glucose. And HHS actually has a higher mortality rate, more profound dehydration and electrolyte disturbances. And remember that fluids are first line for HHS well before you start any insulin.
Monday's noon conference was neuro mini cases with Chris Briscoe-Abath and Agnes Kilian. We went over a few different cases. Case one was a 16-year-old with no past medical history presented with a seizure who went on to be diagnosed with a hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasia. I learned that 10% of people with this diagnosis will have cerebral vascular malformations, but up to 90% will have pulmonary AVMs that can be very dangerous. Case two was a 12-year-old with new onset bothersome movements. Family was concerned about tics and had read about PANDAS online. Importantly, they had taken a video that they showed the doctor, which showed choreiform movements and upon further history had a sore throat 3 weeks ago. Overall, the clinical picture was concerning for acute rheumatic fever with syndonyms chorea. Case three was a 2-year-old with parental concerns about pupil asymmetry. This patient ended up having a relative afferent pupillary defect or RAPD and was eventually diagnosed with Horner syndrome, which again is meiosis, which occurs due to unopposed parasympathetic stimulation anhidrosis and what was it again?
Ptosis.
Yeah, ptosis. Okay, let me try that again. Case three was a two-year-old boy with parental concerns about pupil asymmetry. He ended up being diagnosed with a relative afferent pupillary defect secondary to Horner syndrome. Once again, Horner syndrome is ptosis, meiosis, and anhidrosis. The meiosis occurs due to unopposed parasympathetic sympathetic stimulation. He then went on to have further imaging, which showed a neuroblastoma.
Well, some fascinating cases. Tuesday morning, we had BCRP rounds with Dr. Kristen Scott, who presented a case of a 2-year-old with spontaneous right-sided nosebleed that took 40 minutes to resolve, though just resolved with pressure, and some great teaching on nosebleeds, first thing on exam, always looking for septal hematoma, foreign body, skin exam for any other evidence of bleeding or bruising. Red flags for epistaxis involve lasting greater than 30 minutes despite correct pressure, refractory to acute measures, children less than 2 years of age, more than 2 to 3 times per week for several weeks, or any other concern for bleeding disorder. Thinking about thrombocytopenia, as this patient was ultimately diagnosed with ITP, some good buckets to think about are decreased production, increased destruction and sequestration. And just quick plug for the ITP grading criteria that you can find on UpToDate for severity of bleeding symptoms. They're graded 1 through 4. 1 through 3 are generally managed the same way, and grade 4 is managed more urgently / emergently. Wednesday morning's conference was brought to us by Chief Emeritus Emily Cross, presenting on musculoskeletal pain and low back pain in a 16-year-old female tennis player. She presented her own version of IPAS to compete with TEDS, where IPAS stands for inspection, palpation, active and passive range of motion, strength, special tests, and compare to the unaffected side if possible as part of your back exam. Some other pearls that I took away were that for scoliosis, right-sided thoracic curve is most common. If you see a leftward curve, you should think non-idiopathic, and it's generally not painful on its own. And mechanical back pain is a catch-all term, and it's an injury that does not involve the bony structure. So there should be no red flags, a reassuring exam, and it's a diagnosis of exclusion.
Wednesday's noon conference was a case by our very own Kate Michelson. She presented a two-month-old with history of a dry cough who came in with a fever. Upon evaluations, labs were overall normal, but a chest x-ray showed an enlarged cardiac silhouette. On echo, this patient was diagnosed with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy and then ultimately was diagnosed with Pompe's disease. Some pearls that I took away was, first of all, when you take a look at the EKG, make sure to look at the standard. This patient had an EKG that overall looked okay, but if you adjusted for the standard, they actually met biventricular hypertrophy by the voltage criteria. Second, POCUS can be a really important kind of tool in these situations. Again, you have four views on POCUS: peristernal short, peristernal long, apical four chamber, and the subxiphoid view. But important to remember that POCUS will mainly assess just the function, whether or not it's normal or abnormal, and whether or not there's an effusion. And then finally, some takeaways about hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. The differential for hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is actually pretty short. It can either be idiopathic, which is around 75% of cases. It can be secondary to metabolic disease. It can be in conjunction with a malformation syndrome, including Noonan syndrome, or it can be secondary to a neuromuscular disorder, such as Friedreich's ataxia. And finally, I learned that Pompe's disease was added to the Massachusetts newborn screen in 2018. This patient presented before then, so if was born today, hopefully the diagnosis would be caught on the newborn screen.
Do you think the siren is okay?
I think so. It usually doesn't pick up stuff in the...
And then Thursday's new conference was supporting pediatric patients with behavioral and mental health diagnoses with Dr. Sonia Tanisia and Olivia Miller, board certified behavioral analyst. They went over the huge increases in behavioral health ED visits and admissions since the pandemic. The factors that contributed to these numbers included an increase in isolation, anxiety, and other stressors in conjunction or at the same time as there was a decrease in outpatient mental health supports. Boarding times pre-pandemic were actually 5 to 7 hours in the ED, 2 to 3 days on the inpatient side. And post-pandemic, as we've all seen at this point, boarding times are now averaging over 60 hours in the ED and up to 1 week on the inpatient side. Dr. Tanisia went over the different types of restraints, which includes chemical and mechanical, and then went over some really, really important health equity data about how Black race was associated with restraint use in adults and children, highlighting that racism is a likely cause of this disparity more than anything else. Then Olivia Miller went on to talk about the really understanding the ABCs of behavior. The A stands for antecedent, which is what happened before the behavior. The B is the behavior itself. What did it actually look like? C is consequence, what happened directly after the behavior. And she also went over the different functions of behavior, which includes meeting some sort of sensory or stimulation sort of need. It can act as an escape. It can be for attention, and it can be in order for the child to get something tangible as well. Some important considerations in managing escalated patients include making sure that you're always using a calm voice, using concrete and simple language, reducing stimulation, responding sometimes by not responding, redirection to safe behavior, and then always being mindful of your body positioning.
Friday morning, we had case of the week at BMC, which was a phenomenal presentation by Joan Lee, who presented the case of a 20-year-old male who presented with 3 weeks of fevers and bloody diarrhea, who was ultimately diagnosed with Crohn's disease with a super infection. Some great pearls from this case were really, when you're thinking about IBD, look for growth failure. Vast majority of these people have some kind of weight faltering, and 40% have height faltering as well. So always checking those growth curves, even in the ED, if you have access to them. There's a lot of diagnostic uncertainty in terms of infectious colitis versus IBD, but some good discussion about steroid use, which I think we're always a little hesitant of when we're thinking about infections, but steroids do have a role in some infections if inflammation is the primary driver of the pathophysiology. And finally, one of the biggest takeaways that I had from Joan's case was really just thinking about patients' lives outside of the hospital once they've been diagnosed with chronic disease, whether it be IBD or something like cystic fibrosis or some other chronic condition, the psychosocial impacts and the effects that it has on their everyday lives, and thinking about treating both the disease and the systemic factors. And a great read that I was put onto by my co-host Jamie Lim was a talk by Don Berwick called To Isaiah that I think everyone should look up and read, and is such a powerful reminder of what is required of us in this profession.
And then finally, Friday's morning conference was given by Dr. YY Yang, and it was about pain, agitation, and delirium in the PICU. The main takeaway from this was that there are validated scores to assess and monitor pain, agitation, and delirium. For pain, there's the NPAS, FLAC, NRS, Wong-Baker, and Comfort-B scores. For agitation, there are the RAS, Comfort-B, or the SBS score, which is what is preferred at NOTSOB. And then for delirium, you can use tools such as the CAPD score, the PCAM-ICU, the PSCAM-ICU, or the SOS-PD. All right, moving on to my favorite part of the week, going over our tilts. Once again, Fish learned much more than I did this week, so I'll let you get started.
I have much more to learn. My first tilt of the week was jumping off Emily Cross's orthopedic knowledge, of which I have very little. The Lisfranc injury in pediatrics occurs from a direct blow to your foot after a jump or fall or forced dorsiflexion with a rotational force. Look for pain or swelling at the base of the first and second metatarsal, and you can test it by holding the hind foot, abducting and pronating the forefoot. And if you elicit pain, that's a significant concern. You should always get weight-bearing films. If they're non-weight-bearing, you can miss this, and that includes AP, lateral, and oblique. And if you notice a Lisfranc fracture, the reason that this is so important is that it always requires orthopedic follow-up. Oftentimes, any displacement greater than 2 millimeters requires surgical management and can lead to arthritis and disunion if it's missed.
So a Lisfranc injury is always involves a fracture?
It's like I think it's like a ligament injury, yeah. And it leads to displacement. So I don't know if it's necessarily like a fracture.
Okay, yeah. Because I think that was my understanding of it too, is that it's mainly a ligament. I can go next. I was listening to a great podcast that was part of Neff Madness 2022, where they talked about how sometimes in infants with UTIs, they may actually present first with a metabolic acidosis, hyponatremia, and hyperkalemia. That's actually consistent with a pseudohypoaldosterone syndrome. So if you have an infant who has all these metabolic derangements, but metabolic disease, you know, most importantly, like congenital adrenal hyperplasia is ruled out, even if they're not presenting with a fever, grab a urinalysis and a urine culture, because they may actually have a UTI.
Is that similar to like an RTA type 4 then? Yeah. Picture from the UTI?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The more you tilt.
The more you tilt.
My next tilt was a retrospective study of higher doses of intranasal fentanyl that were used in the ED, showing that it actually had similar safety to lower doses, even when used in combination with intranasal midazolam. And while this study didn't look at if increased doses actually had any improved pain control, which is a very necessary follow-up, it was just a nice reminder that not everything has to be done with IV, and pain control through other means is very important. So remembering your intramuscular, intranasal, and other modalities as well.
Yeah, I love intranasal pain meds. It's so great because you don't have to use an IV. Cool. And then my next and last tilt for the day was something that I learned just today. So there was a recent study that validated the use of a clinical decision rule to judge whether or not bruising in children younger than 4 years was or was not consistent with signs of non-accidental trauma. The clinical decision rule used a mnemonic 10-4 faces P, which admittedly is not the catchiest or easiest to remember. But the 10-4 faces P stands for any bruising that you see on the torso, ear, neck, if they're 4 months or younger, frenulum, angle of the jaw, cheek, eyelids, subconjunctivae, or if there's any sort of patterned bruising, those have pretty high test characteristics for non-accidental trauma. And so you should always keep that in mind. There's a really important part of the study where they actually did the analysis stratified by different skin tones, and they actually found that the test characteristics did not differ by skin color, which I think is a really, really important kind of point and a really important part of the study that they did.
I love that the authors took that very important next step to evaluate for that as well. My final two tilts to round out the week are, one, just a nice study in the ICU showing that hypertonic saline is safe to give through a peripheral IV. We learn a lot of times that like pressors and a lot of these medications can only be given through central lines. And while they're probably safer through central lines, it's nice to know that they can still be used with peripherals. And this study showed that hypertonic saline really had no significant worse outcomes when pushed through a peripheral IV. Now, when given through an infusion, there is a slightly higher risk, but if you need to push it in an acute setting, which is probably most of the time you're giving hypertonic, feel free to use it through a peripheral. And finally, high flow has become all of the rage, and there's a lot of discussion about its effects on PEEP and how it reduces work of breathing. And a new amazing in vivo study of high flow nasal cannula actually shows the mechanism of action is probably more through dead space washout rather than PEEP, as there's no ultimate change in tidal volume or like your end expiratory lung volumes.
This week, we're really lucky to have one of our interns, Dr. Sarah Myers, who's here to talk to us about a very cool clothing exchange that she helped organize to benefit a great organization that she's going to tell us a little bit more about. Sarah, can you tell us a little bit about the clothing exchange that you organized this past weekend?
Yeah, so Sonia Taneha, who's one of the juniors and rising chiefs, had suggested the idea of doing a mixer between the UHAT track and the Diversity Council as a clothing and book swap, since it's kind of spring cleaning time. The idea is that everyone cleans out their books and clothes, shoes, all of that jazz. And we brought it over to Sonia's. Yeah, then we were sort of left with like tons and tons of bags of clothes and boxes of books, which we then brought to donate to More Than Words, which is a really awesome association that one of our seniors in UHAT, AJ Mel, had just highlighted during his wrap session.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit more about More Than Words and what they do, where they're located?
Yeah. So More Than Words, their main location is 242 East Berkeley Street, not far at all from BMC. They also have collection boxes set up all over the city, and they have another main location in Waltham. So it's a really cool organization who essentially work with sort of systems involved youth. So teenagers and young adults who've been involved in the carceral system, who've been involved in foster care, who are homeless or housing insecure, and essentially helps them, sort of gives them the structure and to run like book and clothing stores. So the More Than Words space is a really gorgeous, like large bookstore. I actually like remember looking at it, renting it out when I was planning my wedding a couple of years ago, which didn't end up happening due to COVID. But so these teenagers and young adults essentially like work. They also get a lot of social support. They have the organization has a lot of really cool success stories with kids who've been kind of diverted away from the carceral system into being able to go to college, being able to sort of parlay their work experience for More Than Words into other careers. I read one of the success stories online is a guy who ended up going into like the culinary business and culinary school. So I think it's a really cool sort of grassroots local organization. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. I remember when I was an intern, actually, like one of our wrap sessions involved taking like a field trip to the actual bookstore in the site of More Than Words. But like you said, such a cool organization that provides a lot of like mentorship, like you said, social support to kind of, you know, more vulnerable youth. I also remember hearing some success stories that was really, really inspiring. Thanks for telling us about that, Sarah. Can you let our audience know like where they might be able to learn more about More Than Words? Do they have a website that they can check out?
I would definitely recommend checking out their website, mtwyouth.org. Especially from an advocacy perspective, you can see some of the work they're doing around the Raise the Age campaign, which is a campaign to move emerging adults ages 18 to 20 out of the adult justice system, which is often even more punitive and even more unsafe and violent for emerging adults than the juvenile justice system, which is obviously not ideal either, but certainly theoretically has more of an eye toward rehabilitation and less of an eye toward, you know, punishment than the adult justice system.
Yeah. Cool. Awesome. Thanks, Sarah. Well, this has been another episode of BCR Pod. I'm Jamie Lim.
And I'm Michael Fishman. Before we sign off, any upcoming events you want to let our audience know about?
Well, Tuesday is BCRP Retreat and BCRP Olympics, which I'm really excited for, even though I don't really know what it's going to be like. And I'm also not sure whether or not this episode will come out before or after the retreat, but we'll see.
Sounds exciting.
We want to thank Chris Justin, our advisor, and our future sponsors if you're out there. Our theme music is Sweet Disposition by The Temper Trap, covered by our very own Michael Fishman. And our incidental music is The Four Open Notes of a Ukulele, played by yours truly.
Thanks for joining us, and we hope you'll tune in next week for our next episode of BCR Pod.